Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Today we start in South LA, the USC area. Elizabeth Hernandez is sitting outside of her two-bedroom apartment under a pair of trees. When she first put those trees here years ago, they were potted sprigs from a discount store.
These trees were from the 99 cents, you know, little trees. And look how big they are.
Hernandez's husband has lived here for more than 20 years. When she moved in, the couple had three small kids between them. Now, they've grown, like the trees.
My stepdaughter, it's 21. My oldest son is 17. I have a 13-year-old and a 7-year-old. This has been their home for 10 years already.
But now, their days here are probably numbered. See, back in the spring of 2019, this property went from being low-income housing with limits on rent to market-rate housing. The Hernandez family couldn't afford the rent anymore, and they stopped paying. Well, now they're way behind, and their landlord is evicting them. That flip from affordable to market rate is happening to thousands more homes across Los Angeles, and KCRW reporter Anna Scott is here to talk about it. Hey, Anna.
Hey, Steve.
Now, this began a couple of years ago when Hernandez's building, and I mentioned it at the top, went from affordable to what's called market rate. Why did that happen?
A lot of affordable housing in Los Angeles has an expiration date on it. So, you know how a long time ago, really starting in the late 1930s, the federal government in this country put a lot of money into building public housing?
Yes. I mean, it's actually something that we've talked about on this program before. I mean, some of those projects are still around.
Yeah, they are. And I mention this because after the government got out of that business and started looking instead at what it would take to get the private sector to build affordable housing for them, that set the stage of so much about how affordable housing still works today, including this phenomenon of time limits, or covenants as they're called. The government loans developers money to build affordable projects, and the developers commit to typically 30 or maybe 50 years of affordability. In the case of Elizabeth Hernandez's building, it was built in the 1980s. It was owned by an affordable housing developer for a long time. The rent restrictions expired in 2019, and last year, the developer sold the building to a regular real estate investor. You can imagine that back in the 1980s, the thinking was, well, by the time this deal expires, the tenants will have lots of similar options. We'll have solved our housing problems, right?
Yeah, and we know how that worked out.
Yes. No, of course, we are in a real housing crisis now. And in 2019, Elizabeth Hernandez's apartment was one of 3,600 apartments in the city of Los Angeles to reach its affordability expiration date. This isn't just an issue in the city, though. In LA County, there are about 30,000 affordable homes, and at least a third of those are likely to expire in the next 5 to 10 years. And this is true in San Francisco, in Orange County, all over California, there are projects like this. For Elizabeth Hernandez, when that expiration date came, her rent before, it was a little less than $900 a month. Now, she says it's $1,800 a month. It more than doubled. It's way out of reach. Her husband works in building maintenance. She's mostly been a stay-at-home mom with a little business making custom party cakes on the side, and they can't afford that.
Did she know, or did they know, that the rent increase was coming?
Yes. It's generally required that tenants in these buildings get at least a year's notice when this happens. She says she wasn't clear on exactly how much her rent would go up, and she and her husband felt that they wouldn't be able to find anything comparable nearby. A big two-bedroom for less than $900 a month, that's close to her kids' schools. So they decided to stay put as long as they possibly could.
I'm scared. You know, if we have to leave, we won't be able to find something real quick. I know that for sure. Or something that we can afford at the moment. So we're going to have to split. I would have to send probably one of my children with my aunt. I would have to send the other one with his dad's side of the family. My husband would have to go to his sister's, and I will probably have to go with my mom and the little one. It's going to be something really hard.
Mm. Yeah, now since the pandemic started, she says their income has tanked more, so they're even deeper in the financial hole.
So, Anna, how have she and her family managed to stay put for the past 2 years?
In a few ways. One is that this didn't go straight to eviction. There were attempts to negotiate a deal. I reached out to the prior landlord and the current building owner. I didn't hear back from the previous owner, but I did talk to an attorney named Charlie Stein, who represents the current landlord, who has owned the property for about a year. He says his client offered money to help the remaining low-income tenants with relocation, that the current $1,800 a month rent for Elizabeth Hernandez's apartment is about $500 below market rate. For Hernandez, she says that's still out of reach, and she and her family are about one of a half dozen older households still remaining at the property who stopped paying rent around the time the covenants expired, are now facing eviction, yet have been attempting to hang on as long as they possibly can. And in that regard, they've benefited by the relatively slow pace of eviction court, particularly during the pandemic. Hernandez's next hearing in the eviction case is in June.
And the landlord says he tried to work out deals and has his own expenses at the property, I assume.
Yes, his lawyer, Stein, says they tried hard to find ways for older tenants to stay, but they simply can't have people not paying rent for months or years on end.
And Hernandez isn't protected by, you know, the eviction moratoriums that have been in place during the pandemic. Is that true?
That's right. And that's for a few reasons, including that her eviction case started before the pandemic started.
And you mentioned the next court date is in just a couple of months, in June. Is there anything that the city could do to help her family qualify for maybe a new low-income housing unit? I mean, wouldn't that be a win-win for everyone, including the landlord?
City officials are looking into ways to help tenants in buildings with expiring covenants relocate to comparable homes. Because she's not the only person in this situation. Between this year and the end of 2023, another 3,600 affordable apartments are set to hit their limits in Los Angeles, in the city of Los Angeles. City officials don't want homelessness to get worse. So City Council member Gil Cedillo is one person who's concerned about this. And he says this issue of expiring covenants is so big, it could basically cancel out a lot of the new affordable housing that's being built in the city.
That's a lot. That wipes out whatever gains we make. All of them are coming due, and we need to make sure that there's a way to continue them.
He's been trying to get the city to buy one building in his district that's like this, Hillside Villa in Chinatown, so it could be publicly owned and go back to being affordable. But that's ongoing, and the city can't afford to do that with every property. So Cedillo recently asked for recommendations from city housing staff and lawyers for the city for keeping more buildings from going from affordable to market rate.
And he asked for recommendations. I mean, what's the city doing in the meantime?
Well, they are working on a report to come up with those recommendations. Actually, Cedillo first asked for those recommendations 2 years ago in June 2019, and then recently updated the motion just last month to take into account the pandemic.
So, Anna, what are some possible solutions to this covenants issue? I mean, this is a big deal. If the developers who built these buildings then fulfilled their obligations, you can't force them to extend the deals, right?
No. And I spoke with a spokesperson for the California Apartment Association who said that if the city takes some sort of punitive action against building owners, that could hurt their efforts to build affordable housing projects in the future because developers may not trust that the city is going to keep to its word. At the state level, a group of legislators recently introduced a bill that would give tax benefits to owners who sell covenanted properties to housing nonprofits that would then keep the properties affordable for 55 years.
For 55 years from now. So I look forward to talking to you about all this again in 2076.
If I am alive in 2076, I really hope that we can talk about something else by then.
I can assure you I will not be here in 2076, but I look forward to talking to you often and obviously a very important subject. KCRW's Anna Scott, who covers housing and homelessness for us. Anna, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Charles and Willa Bruce paid about $1,000 for a slice of Manhattan Beach back in 1912. They built a resort as an oceanside haven for black people to swim and lounge and just enjoy. But the Bruces and the beachgoers endured years of racism and harassment. And by 1924, just 12 years later, the city forced the Bruces to sell the land and leave. Today, it's worth about $75 million. Well, now there are plans to return the land to descendants of the Bruces.
Because they not only were stripped of their property, they lost their business, and they spent the rest of their lives working for someone else versus running their own business and providing jobs, not only for their family, but a variety of other African-Americans over the last 100 years.
That's Senator Stephen Bradford. He, along with Senator Ben Allen and other local officials, introduced a bill today to return the oceanfront parcel to the Bruces. Well, one of their descendants is Chief Dwayne Yellowfeather Shepherd of the Pocasset Wampanoag Tribe of the Poconocut Nation, and he's with us on the line right now. Chief, welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How do you feel about this bill and the people who are trying to get this land back to your family?
Well, the family is ecstatic that finally someone that has any influence has taken up the issue of trying to get justice for our family. This bill is important because there's a reversion clause that Senator Janice Hahn wants to give the property. I mean, I keep calling her senator. Hopefully one
supervisor.
Day. But Supervisor. Supervisor Janice Hahn wants to return the property to our family because the park was built on other people's land that they had also taken through eminent domain, but the County of Los Angeles Lifeguard Training Center sits right directly on our land down on the coast.
I want to talk about the park because the whole eminent domain, where you have to sell this land to us because we want to condemn it and make it into a city park, a public park, right? And that park didn't take place for many years.
They took it in 1927. They didn't put a park there until 1957.
So what happens to the land when they get it back to your family? I mean, right now there's a lifeguard training facility, right?
Yeah. Well, we're still in the discussions and negotiations with the county. One option that we've discussed is possibly returning the ownership of the land to our family, and then we lease it to the County of Los Angeles so they can keep the lifeguard station training facility there for 99 years, and we charge fair market value rent.
So, and market value rent, you know, I mean, as I mentioned, the land is worth millions of dollars, a lot more than the family paid for it many years ago. Is there a plan for how any restitution would be dispersed among the descendants? I mean, there are a lot of folks in the family, right?
Well, there are a lot of folks in the family, but the direct descendants of Charles and Willa Bruce, we're a large family, but the direct descendants of his genealogical line, or their genealogical line, is Anthony Bruce, the great-great-grandson. So the ownership would go back to him, and then we amongst the family will talk internally about how there can be some sharing of the land.
Chief, the Bruces and their descendants, you could say that they lost, like, generational wealth, because over the course of all of those decades, 100 years or more, well, nearly 100 years, 1924, that they didn't own this property anymore. I mean, they could have leased it. They could have made a lot of money on the land. It was a part of the beach community there. I mean, do you see and feel a direct impact of what happened 100 years ago on the direct descendants? I mean, we're talking more than just $75 million, right?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, it was devastating. They were prominent business owners at that time. They had a dance hall there. They had a restaurant there. They had a bathhouse. They sold water novelties. Willa had talked about possibly building a hotel there. You had the socialites from South Los Angeles and the politicians and even the black gangsters coming there and having social affairs there as well. So they were making quite a bit of money. And so the loss of the generational wealth has been devastating to us. Her great-great-grandson, Anthony, still walks to work. He doesn't have a vehicle, you know, even after being a veteran. So therefore, scholarships have not been paid. The what's the other thing that I'm looking about? Mortgages You know, we haven't had opportunity to buy homes and whatever. We're mostly living below the poverty line here, still after 96 years.
Are you concerned about locals in Manhattan Beach who are maybe against this? You know, there have been some council meetings in the past where some folks have gotten up and said, hey, we don't want to apologize for something that happened so long ago.
Well, first of all, the Bruce family's not in, we're not interested in an apology. We want the restoration of our land. We want restitution for that loss of revenue that we would have had for 96 years. And we want punitive damages for the Manhattan Beach City Council and the Manhattan Police Department colluding with the Ku Klux Klan to terrorize our family. So the apology would be for them to show that their youth, that they are mature enough to understand that a wrong has been done and that they would want to apologize for it and set the example. But they seem not to be able to do that, and they keep falling over themselves with asking for acknowledgments or want to give acknowledgments and then ask us for forgiveness. We're not forgiving them for what happened to our family. We want restitution and we want justice.
You want justice? I mean, I know there's a plaque there right now. What's the plaque say?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the most important thing is that the plaque is praising George Peck, the owner of the land down there, as the person who set aside land for the use of African Americans, which is totally incorrect. From my research, it looks like he was probably colluding with the Ku Klux Klan to get us out of there. He cordoned off and put up trespassing signs right in front of the property. So even though we had all that property there and that business there, people could not directly leave the property and go straight into the ocean. They had to walk a half mile either way in order to get in the ocean. And it still did not deter our family or our visitors.
What happens from here, Chief? I mean, well, number one, I mean, we've got this, you know, in the state Senate now up in Sacramento. You've got Supervisor Hahn who's really trying to push something forward here. I mean, do you think what you're talking about, restitution, you don't want an apology, you want restitution. You want what's rightfully, you know, the families. I mean, what's next?
Probably some type of litigation. You know, Manhattan Beach has flat out said that they're not going to give us anything. They had a task force that made a lot of recommendations for them to do some community forums and pay restitution to the family and also give an apology. They refused to do anything of that nature. So we have no choice but to litigate them. We have to take them to court. This has been a criminal act. What they did under the guise of municipal policy using eminent domain was a criminal act to railroad my people out of that city.
You think something like that could happen today in 2021?
Oh, absolutely. There's no difference here in 2021 as it is in 1921. Manhattan Beach is still a racist bastion there. And a lot of racist acts have happened just recently with the surfers out there at El Porto and there in Manhattan Beach just in the last month. Now they're passing out flyers from the KKK. And, Newport Beach and Huntington Beach. So we have no idea what could possibly happen. All we know is we want our land back and then we'll deal whatever comes toward us toe to toe.
I know you got involved with Justice for Bruce's Beach. This is a movement down there. Where did that originate?
That originated with a young lady named Kavon Ward back Juneteenth last year. Had seen the plaque. Did a little research on the history of Bruce's Beach, and decided to hold demonstrations in support of giving the beach back to our people. And so she started this organization called Justice for Bruce's Beach, which is on Instagram and Facebook.
I want to thank you, Chief, for joining us today and telling the story. And we'd love to get an update from you in the future to see what happens. Chief Dwayne Yellowfeather Shepherd, an
Absolutely.
Actor living here in L.A. and one of the hundreds of Bruce family descendants. Chief, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, just south of the South Bay, let's head to Orange County. Down in Huntington Beach yesterday, an expected so-called White Lives Matter protest never quite materialized. Reports of Ku Klux Klan flyers announcing the rally did bring out a few hundred counter-protesters, and there were a few scuffles and a handful of arrests, too. Meanwhile, a number of city councils around Orange County are talking about how to respond to racism, particularly the recent spate of anti-Asian hate incidents. And LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano joins us now with today's KCRW Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So what happened in Huntington Beach yesterday? Was there a so-called White Lives rally?
No, the expected thing that was going to happen in Huntington Beach. So the actual Ku Klux Klan members were tiny, insignificant, far outnumbered by counter-protesters. But then in the most HB thing imaginable, you had people protesting not the Klan, but Black Lives Matter people saying they're the real racists, they're the problem, waving Trump flags, even though, hey, the election happened, what was it, like 4 months ago or something? And that's where the scuffles broke out. So, Huntington Beach, of course, longtime hotbed of racism. But this, I knew this rally wasn't going to be anything, but I knew the circus was going to be top-notch Surf City.
All right, well, hotbed of racism. Huntington Beach and Santa Ana have both passed resolutions dealing with hate crimes recently, right?
Yeah, no, this is interesting. So after 2020, with, the consciousness raising across the United States when it comes to racial inequity, and then in this past recent year with a rise in anti-Asian hate crimes, you're seeing cities actually finally in Orange County acknowledge that, yes, racism is a thing in Orange County. So you had Huntington Beach and Santa Ana saying, hey, we stand against racism, which, okay, that's not really such a strong stance, but in Orange County, it's extraordinary. But then you're having cities like Irvine, Costa Mesa, even Seal Beach, mulling whether they should ask the police department to issue monthly stats on hate crimes, which is to me, is incredible.
We've talked to you in the past, Gustavo, about Huntington Beach, obviously, but also about Tito Ortiz. He's the mixed martial artist. He's an anti-masker who sits on the city council there. Does it surprise you that Huntington Beach would be out front on this issue?
No, because this is starting to become a black eye in Huntington Beach. This is what it's now, not when it trends on Twitter. It's not because of the cool waves. It's not because of the good restaurants. It's not because of the legendary MMA scene that Tito Ortiz and so many other came from. It's because of these rallies, and not just anything, small rallies like the KKK, but anti-coronavirus rallies, anti-mask rallies, anti-vax rallies. Like, this is starting to become a citywide embarrassment. So even the people who say, like, yeah, we don't really like liberals here, but like, we can't have this, because especially at a time where the tourism industry is ready to go, Huntington Beach wants those dollars. They don't want those dollars to go to, say, Newport Beach. Yeah, or Newport Beach, a city that's just as racist, but never gets the same attention that Huntington Beach does.
You mentioned Irvine as well. Tomorrow, the city council there is expected to discuss a resolution dealing with hate crimes. Tell us more about what they're considering.
So it's interesting with Irvine, because at this point, it's probably a majority Asian city, huge populations of Taiwanese, Chinese, Persian. So you've had hate crimes there happening over the past couple of years. So the Irvine City Council wants to, within the city, talk among each other, like, okay, what can we do to stop these hate crimes? But also ask the police department again to say, you need to start tracking hate crimes. You need to start issuing a monthly report on what's going on. Because I think a lot of times, when you hear the term hate crime, you don't exactly know what it is. But when you see the actual crime, say someone assaulted, someone yelled at, I think that makes it more tangible for the population at large. And honestly, in this day and age, like, really, a hate crime? That's just it's so 1950s. Why are you even bothering with crap like that?
All of this, Gustavo, follows a bunch of anti-Asian incidents in the OC and other places. We talked to one man who moved his family from China to Ladera Heights several years ago. Soon after they got there, they were starting to get harassed. Teenagers were targeting their house, throwing rocks, things like that. The good news, though, is that neighbors rallied around them and started to protect them. Do you feel like there's been a positive response across Orange County to racism like that?
Absolutely. Again, as a lifelong resident and as the most loving hater of Orange County history and racism, seeing these actions of neighbors to rally around their neighbors, it's unprecedented. I remember, when was it? Maybe over a decade ago, there was an African-American sergeant in the LAPD that was living in Yorba Linda, was getting his car scratched and all of that. And the neighbors told the press, oh, this guy is, exaggerating. And there can't possibly be racism in Orange County in Yorba Linda. So to see what happened in Ladera Ranch, to see what's happening, even just people, again, I said this before last year, but to have Orange County residents saying Black Lives Matter, this in a county where less than 3% of the population is Black, it's unprecedented. It's a step in the right direction. Let's just hope Orange County doesn't do its usual thing of leaping three steps back.
LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano. Every week he joins us for KCRW's Orange County Line. Gustavo, as always, thank you.
Gracias.
And let's also clarify that Huntington Beach is also one of those cities that has asked its police department to provide reports on hate crimes going forward, part of what appears to be a growing trend in Orange County, something that we're going to keep tabs on as well. And that's going to do it for us this evening. Tomorrow, to the San Fernando Valley we go, and how, unlike what U2 sang, the streets do have names, and those names actually mean something. Check us out online at kcrw.com/greaterLA, and you can find every episode of GLA online. Get the show fresh to your feed by subscribing to the podcast, and let us know how you're doing, too. What are you doing now that you're vaccinated, if you have been vaccinated? We'd love to help share your story as well at kcrw.com. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, John Meek, Ray Guarna, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordall all made the show happen this evening. Thanks for your ears and time tonight. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great night.